This is a recording from Reunions Weekend 2011 at the University of Virginia, made possible by the UVA Alumni Association. This session is a panel discussion from the class of 1971.
Okay, we'll go ahead and get started this afternoon. And what a great honor to be here with a panel with some great people that you see in front of you for the class of 71. And when I was asked to put this on, I thought you had a great opportunity to get folks together. And we're going to have fun today. And so this afternoon, we've got a little bit more than an hour to talk with some great classmates of ours. In your handout is their biographies. I won't go into all the details, but because you've got them right here in front of you. We're going to have each presenter talk about 10 minutes. And I'd like to hold our questions till the end. And I think we will have time at the end for questions of either individual panelists or for the group as a whole, or to make comments. So even if you don't have a question and you'd like to share and add some more information to what we're going to do today, please do. And we want this to be a real good chance to exchange information and talk about what the university was like when we were here, some of the things we have done. My name is Mike Moose, and I'm on the committee, and I hope that everybody is enjoying the music CD. If you haven't got one already, I've got some here. We'll have some more tonight at the banquet. If you haven't got one, please let me know, and we'll have some more tonight to hand out as well. Now, today on our panel, we have Jim Bradshaw, college, 71. We have Cindy Sanborn, nursing, 71. We have Dan Ryzik with us today, college. And, of course, we have Dr. Sam Graham. So what we will start with, and we might have a few arrivals coming in and finding some good seats over here, and that's fine. I'd like to start off right now with Jim Bradshaw. Jim has pretty much been in Hilton Head, I hate to use the word forever, but he's been there a long time. And he's got some great experiences when he was here as a student and also since 1971. And it's a great pleasure for me to introduce Jim Bradshaw.
Thank you, Mike. It's an honor for me to be here to address my fellow classmates. I want to dedicate my talk to my mother. Her name was Christine Hudson Bradshaw, excuse me. But she taught me something very early, or empowered me, by saying, Jimmy, you can do anything you want to. And part of that experience, of course, was getting admitted to the University of Virginia, and choosing to attend the University of Virginia. But why did I come to Virginia is the way I wanted to start things out. Luckily, about the ninth grade, it was determined by some other people that I was a good student. But I wasn't, excuse me, applying myself. And like Lee Garrett, I was in the schools of Southside Virginia. Today, Halifax County High School has no AP courses. Luckily, we did at that time, and the teachers were relatively good and certainly inspired me. But the guidance counselors encouraged me. I applied to two Ivy League schools, to Berkeley. I got into those schools. I got a scholarship there. But I had developed an allegiance to UVA. I sold Bibles in high school for two summers, once in Texas, another in Iowa, and a number of students in their group were UVA students, including a fellow named Jim Chaffin, some of you may know. He developed little places like Snowmass in Colorado, Kiowa, he worked for Sea Pines, etc. And he was a childhood friend, a 1967 graduate, and he was a role model. And then another man named Ted Bennett, who went on to be a Virginia politician. So the man that brought the bacon home to Halifax County was here as well, and I in part followed them. Also, there was a comfort level. I had 10 classmates from the high school. This year we have one student from the high school attending, but 10 of us attended, and only three of us graduated on time. They're Barry Glenn, Bob Vaughn, and myself. Ed Trope, who's a great guy, many people know. I think Trope was on the seven-year program, and then some others just went on to bigger things. I am indebted to Dean Canterbury, who was the dean of, I want to say admissions. Financial aid, pardon me. And I was granted a DuPont scholarship, and I couldn't have come to UVA without that. I arrived partially prepared. I had a roommate the first year, DeWitt Kassler, and DeWitt Kassler had gone to St. Christopher's, and he'd go to bed every night at 10 o'clock, and I'd just be beginning, you know, just getting it, and I'm trying to solve this damn problem, and luckily I had DeWitt to ask advice of, and other students that are better prepared than I, and really tutored at times, counseled, so forth. Very collegiate settings, we all know. And I considered that first year the beginning of my Renaissance life experience. I developed a broad interest in reading, a real passion for learning, and then through the reading and classes, exploring other cultures. And as you'll see in my story, that's where I've spent most of my life, exploring. I met Mr. Barrett. Who here remembers Mr. Barrett by chance? Mr. Barrett was an industrialist, a railroad magnate, and he eventually created the Rare Book Room at the university with American First Editions. Anyway, I met him because I studied in the library, and he mentored me, and I've become an avid book collector also. I had some academic success here. It sort of goes back to my mother empowering me. Lots of fun socially. I see a lot of people that I spent a lot of time doing those very things that we did in those years, just having a great time. I've established, and I see many friends here, lifelong friendships, which are priceless to me, of course. Now turning to my relationship with my teachers, I was an of-need student, so I worked in the psychology department, and I really developed special relationships with a number of my professors, particularly Dr. Richard Henneman, who would take me to Farmington Country Club many days during the week for lunch. And they never asked how old I was, so I would drink with him at lunch. So we were in great shape by the time we got back to the psychology department. But he hosted a lunch for my family. I'm indebted to him when I graduated. It was most elegant, and he was quite a mentor. As for other members of the class who lived on the lawn, I think the capstone of my UVA experience was that year that we were on the lawn, getting to know people that I didn't know very well prior to that, but sharing and doing lots of fun things. Really strong memory and a concern that I experienced at UVA was the Vietnam era. I didn't understand it. I wasn't for it, I wasn't against it. I was interpreting it that the nation was deteriorating. Literally, this country was falling apart. But I had a series of professors I went to discuss the matter with, and they explained to me that several things were occurring simultaneously. One, youth were speaking. And second, that the nation was divided, and it would be a better nation at the end. And I think that has proven to be true. But that was a very, very nerve-wracking, unsettling time. Well, the day I graduated from UVA, I graduated with a strong commitment to pay UVA back. I was fortunate that in my career I've been able to do that. But some of my early giving, I want to share something that relates. I don't know if Falders is here or not, but I came back to UVA. I was living in Puerto Rico, and I wanted to give $5,000 to the psychology honors program. I went to the Alumni Association, and they said, well, just give it to the university fund, we'll take care of it. I said, no, I want to designate it. They said, well, people don't designate. Well, it turned out that in those early days that Gilly Sullivan and Company were the place where you deposited your funds when you gave, but it went into a general fund and then was moved around. I then went to see the dean of the college, Dean Kellogg, I believe at that time, and explained it to him, and he was very thankful, and I asked him, how much money have you all received in the last year? Do you know? He said, $12,000. So we had the largest body of members of the college community, of the university community, and we were receiving really very little money from them directly. For 25 years, and I did it anonymously originally, my wife and I, Carla, and I established a fund, and we've sent 70 students to UVA from Southside Virginia, or helped in some cases because they were awarded other scholarships as well. And that continues. I just awarded one to a young fellow of Indian extraction in South Boston, Virginia last Wednesday. I had the privilege from that interaction with the dean that we got a group together, 25 of us, and we created the College and Arts Science Council, and Graduate School Council, and it became today's foundation. We've skyrocketed in our fundraising, as you well know. I also had a great experience with a man named Larry Simpson, and I'm going to try to speed this up. Larry Simpson, it's hard to do 44 years in 10 minutes, but Larry Simpson was head of career planning and placement, and he mentored me. And I got a number of very interesting job offers. He would introduce me to people that I probably wouldn't have looked at my resume and had any interest in me. And he and I have been lifelong friends since then. He's retired here. But I used Network, which many of our children are having to do today, and Jim Chafin hired me to sell real estate in Hilton Head. So I moved to Hilton Head in 1971 to work for a man named Charles Frazier. It was Camelot. We had this extraordinary development, an easy property to sell, a lot of demand. My first year out of school, I sold $7 million in 1971 dollars. So I don't know what that is today, but it was just remarkable. I spent 2 years there, and then my wanderlust took me to Puerto Rico. I spent 3 years there, and by the time I left on June 18, 1975, the company was broke. Our project had single-handedly bankrupted the Chase Manhattan Real Estate Trust. And it was a very pivotal moment for me because I tasted failure. I tried to understand why did we fail, what did we do wrong, and it came back to cash flow. We ran out of money, so that was a lesson learned. From there, I was able to get a job with Gerald Blakely at Cabot Forbes in Boston on a private basis with his son, who just graduated from Bowdoin College. We sold out a project in 6 months at Cotuit Bay Shores in Cape Cod. From there, Mr. Blakely introduced me to Charles Bluehorn, who owned Casa de Campo, Gulf and Western Industries, Paramount Pictures, etc. And I went to work for that gentleman. It's the only time I've been fired. And what occurred was I found that the gentlemen running the project were stealing millions from Mr. Bluehorn. I told him about it. He fired them. And then the next day he hired him back because they had more on him than he had on them. So he gave me a year's severance and said, where do you want to go? And I said, well, I'll go to Miami. So he sent me to Miami, and I got off in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, though. And I'd been there twice. I had a nice sum of money and a check in my hand, and I went to Bank of Boston, deposited, and I moved to Haiti. My father, by the way, who was a tobacco farmer, told all his friends for the 11 years I was in Haiti that I was working in Tahiti. In Haiti, I established a handicrafts company, which eventually evolved into a company called American Folk Art Limited, Pier 1 Imports, World Bazaar, Penny's, all kinds of customers. Then the young buyers were my friends. They said, come with us to Asia. 2 years into the business, I moved to Asia. So we've got a total of 11 years in Haiti and 10 years in Asia, based in the Philippines. I want to mention this, very important thing I learned along the way. The majority of people in Haiti are illiterate, but they have the greatest dignity of any people I've ever met. Excuse me. And what I witnessed were that every mother and father wants the best for their children, with few exceptions. And the Haitians exemplified that more than anyone. They were having a struggle, of course, but standing behind their families. I'm moving forward now to 1979, 1980. I'm in the Philippines. We're doing contract work in Indonesia, Thailand, China. We're selling in 28 countries. 1978, I started to focus on diversifying my holdings. So I went into commercial real estate in the Southeast, car washes, warehousing, eventually shopping centers. Moving forward to today, started a retail chain in Hilton Head called Camp Hilton Head. And if you buy a t-shirt in Hilton Head, you'll probably buy that t-shirt from my company today, or my partner and I. I had to buy a travel agency because I was traveling so much. I was going around the world 7 times a year. And that was very cost efficient in getting upgrades. That was good stuff. 1988-89, we reached 4,000 employees. That moment, I met my future wife, Carla, in the Philippines. We courted for a year, got married in October 1988. That time, I'd entered a contract to sell my Asian business to a Japanese conglomerate. We moved back to Hilton Head, 2 daughters from Carla's first marriage, my daughters. From there, I was driving people crazy because I didn't have very much to do. I was shutting down Haiti also because it was too dangerous to work there. I've now entered the time that I have my true distinction in the world. I'm the only American to lose both his dictators in the same week. Marcos and Duvalier both left the same week. 1989, I go to Colombia, South America, meet some extraordinary people through the Young Presidents Organization, and now for 20-some years, I've been in the oil business, gas business, flower business. We built high-end security condo projects, four offices, and then we also did a residential community, golf community. It's a great nation, a great people, world-class business partners, and true friends. Lastly, I went to McDonald's and I got the McDonald's franchise in Colombia, and we built 38 McDonald's, and we sold those in 1994. Correspondingly, in 1990, we established the first independent telephone company in Panama. So you can imagine, there was no room. I was just going 1,000 miles an hour. Sold that business, and then my best friend gets sick. Years, excuse me, years 1997. Prior to telling his story, I visited Argentina, and I fell in love with the country. Now Carla and I live there 6 months of the year. We have a ranch in Patagonia. The only commitment there was Carla said I couldn't invest or work in Argentina, which I do not do. Anyway, my good friend has terminal cancer. We spend a month with Mike in hospice. He dies, and it changed my life. And since then, I've been living with this approach to life, this ain't a dress rehearsal. So I've really been doing things that I didn't get to do in the past, such as hunting and fishing and so on. And then I'm not sure the year, but I called Sam, 10 years ago to be exact, Sam Graham, and I said, I got this damn problem. I have prostate cancer. He said, well, why don't you come up here on Sunday night and just stay with us and we'll have dinner and we'll talk about it. And he was sort of nonchalant about it. He said, okay, we'll be there. And he said, oh, by the way, it's an epidemic. And I said, what? And he said, well, Bradshaw, I've got it too. Had the surgery, zero PSA, and moved forward. Raising a family, the joy of that, two girls, grown now, a UVA son-in-law who's a doctor in Beaufort, South Carolina, Katrina, who has a studio arts degree from UVA in 1999, Candace, our single daughter, Charleston, Roanoke College, everyone doing extremely well. Today I have a good team of people that I depend on, which has really allowed me to be free. I have a very patient wife and partner. Reflections on, let me just end it because I know I've been too long. Reflections on my liberal education at UVA. Jefferson is really my idol, and I think that's safe to say for many people. His quest for knowledge was a great inspiration to me. I honed my wanderlust through just learning and studying, and 40 years later, I can say I truly know the world and many, many of its cultures. Established great friends along the way, and today I have a small UVA global network because I've looked for people from UVA. And I think, to close on that subject, I believe our UVA education offered each of us a unique insight in the definition of honor. UVA shortfalls quickly, and I'm going to shut up. Very little exposure to the arts for me. Very few undergraduates from other countries or even Afro-Americans. A lack of co-educational experience in our academic community. Today, great strides have been made. Last thing I'd like to say is something that I learned along the way in the following. You have to be two things to work around the world. Be nimble enough to go where the action is and humble enough to listen once you get there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim, for sharing with us the last 40 years plus four here, of course. We'll move right along to Cindy Sanborn. Cindy came to the university after 2 years at Mary Washington, at that time known as college, and entered the nursing school and has been very influential in the state of Virginia in the area of diabetes. You'll see that a lot in her bio. She has pretty much been able to focus things here through Charlottesville, University of Virginia Medical Center. She is still here and doing some great things for many people, including myself. Although I'm not one of your patients, but I also have to watch my sugar intake starting about a year and a half ago. My doctor said, take it easy, watch what you're doing, and hopefully things will be okay, and so far they are. And so with her insights into Charlottesville University and her medical career, let's welcome Cindy Sanborn.
Thank you very much. I agreed to do this with some trepidation because I feel in many ways I'm speaking from the female perspective. During our college years here, when there were women mostly in the School of Nursing, the School of Education, we had some women who were here in graduate programs, and some women who actually were children of faculty, wives of faculty members. So most of the women here really were concentrated in the School of Nursing and the School of Education. When I came to UVA, I was first exposed to a 6 weeks of quick experience. We all had to come to do a 6 weeks period in the School of Nursing before we actually matriculated and started our final 2 years here in the School of Nursing. So I chose to do that after my first year at Mary Washington, and it was an amazing experience. We learned some basic pathophysiology, we learned about medications. It was our first introduction to the hospital, and really began to learn how to care for patients, sick people, and how to get along, develop rapport, and be a colleague to other staff and physicians in the hospital setting. So it really opened the world in terms of a new life for me. And I quickly knew I had chosen the right thing. It was really a great way, too, for some of my classmates to really find out that it wasn't necessarily what they wanted to do with their lives. And we had some students who decided to drop out or do something else with their careers. Jim has already referred to the turbulent times during the period we were in college. And this really came rushing back to me. 2 weeks ago, I was in Austin, Texas, and visited the Lyndon Johnson Museum and Library, and all the videos of newscasts, his speeches, really came, just brought back an emotional rush of feelings and memories from that period of time. The Vietnam War, the peace movement, women's lib movement, civil rights movement, and I really had an emotional time experience that morning that I spent in that library and museum. And in many ways, it was very timely because it kind of brought back a lot of those experiences, thoughts, and feelings that we all experienced while we were here at the university. I want to describe a bit about a typical day in a nursing student here at UVA, and I really could not have described it better than a piece that one of my good friends and colleagues wrote, and it's actually in the Corks and Curls from our yearbook, the 1971 yearbook. So I'm going to read for you what she wrote about a typical nursing student day back in the late 60s, early 70s. As the sun begins to rise over Mr. Jefferson's university, we can see, hidden by lingering shadows and nestled into the red earthen clay like a groundhog, Mighty McKim, as we all refer to it. At these wee hours when not even a creature is stirring, McKimbo Bimbos, as I think we were like, friendly, called, McKimbo Bimbos are scattering helter-skelter, assuming the daily ritual of transforming last night's hangover or all-night studying into a cheerful smile of a student nurse. There are 18 buttons or snaps which must be attended to while one is attempting to break the starched seal sleeves with her fist. Neither snow nor sleet nor rain deters the student nurse from her pilgrimage through the umbilical cord arcade. And for those of you who don't know, the arcade is a covered pathway that connected McKim Hall, where we lived and studied, had our classes, with the old hospital building. So it was a quick access to the hospital when we were trying to get to clinicals on time. Sorry, I lost my place. We take the role of mothers, sisters, daughters, psychologists, girlfriends, maids, and confessioners. We return to McKim in time to make our afternoon classes, gulp down dinner, and check charts. After our night classes, we settle down to busy paperwork, finally crawling into bed around 2 a.m. or so, only to dread the sound of the 6 a.m. alarm. Obviously, we all must have masochistic tendencies to put ourselves through this kind of torture. And actually, there were wonderful experiences. We learned in a caring way how to care for sick patients. We learned how to be colleagues to other healthcare providers, and really in a difficult environment dealing with illness and sickness to do our best. So from a knowledge and skill gained during my time at UVA, that education has carried me very far, and I just wanted to highlight some things that have really, I think I really gained from my UVA experience. I really learned how to be a leader and how to effectively solve problems. In my work with diabetes, I think I'm really able to apply that in helping my patients determine how to solve some of the problems they have and make some changes in their lives to improve the care for their illness. I learned how to be a caring professional and how to listen, how to really listen to people. And I think I've honed that skill over the years, but I really started my education in that in the School of Nursing at UVA. I learned how to use humor. I learned how to play and have a good time. And I learned the importance of continued learning. And I've tried to be a student and continue to learn all through my profession and the years since I was here at UVA. My closing advice to you as a nurse is to get to know a nurse if you don't already. Develop a relationship with one. They can help you navigate this difficult healthcare system, I think, that's ever-changing and we're all in need of and probably using as we all are here at this age. It's never too late to make healthy lifestyle changes, and that's one thing I focus on with my patients day in and day out. It's never too late to do something that makes you healthier as a human being. And buy long-term care insurance for those of you who haven't. I think that's a really good tip. And then to use a term that from our generation that really I think has been used, probably way overused, we've all come a long way, baby. The university in particular has really at a completely different point from where we were 40 years ago. We have our first female president. Over half of the student body is female now. We have a lot of minorities in here who are students of, and learning. We have a lot of men in the School of Nursing, which was not the case when I was there. We had one male student in my class when I was here. We have a lot of female students in the School of Medicine, and that is a big advance as well. So in closing, I'm really thankful for my time at UVA. I think it's really laid a foundation, certainly for my profession. I've spent most of my professional life here after going to graduate school and coming back. And I owe a lot to the university.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you for sharing that with us today.
I appreciate all your time being with us here this afternoon. Next up, we have Dan Reisig. Dan, as you remember, was on our football team. And after the university experience here, he played football professionally for many years. Then he moved on into the world of finance and big finance. And we're looking forward to hearing from Dan and all the great experiences you had here and since then, Dan. Thanks for being with us.
You know, there's a baseball game going on, if anybody wants to leave. When I was asked to do this, I forget how long ago, a good friend of mine and my college roommate, Andy Selfridge, who works here at the university, I was talking over with him, and he says, "Big Rise, I just came from the 50th reunion. You might want to make the 40th. But I come from a place called Mentor, Ohio, a little bit east of Cleveland, about 25 miles. And I think my being at the university is I was very fortunate to have it happen, because back then I was recruited by several schools. I'd already signed with Bowling Green, a Mid-American Conference school up there in Northwest Ohio. And back then you could sign what they call a letter of intent with specific conferences that just eliminated you from going to any other school in that conference. But anyway, it's late January, and my coach, Dick Crum, who eventually coached, was head coach at UNC for several years, said, hey, I have the offensive coordinator here, Ben Wilson. He looked at your film, and I think he wants to talk to you. So I said, okay, fine, because I was already kind of mentally prepared to do the Bowling Green thing and stay in Ohio. I'm a kind of a home guy. So anyway, he said, well, I'd like you to come down and look at the campus, actually the Browns back then, and just see what you think. So I came down, I fell in love with it, and it's very the best thing that ever happened to me, being here. We have some tremendous classmates. We've got a hero in our presence, I consider, Dave Smith, fighter pilot, defending our country, has done that for us. And something I want to bring in a little more current events. As I mentioned, I'm from Mentor, Ohio, and we have an unfortunate thing going on now at Ohio State Collegiate Athletics. Jim Tressel just resigned. A little background there. His dad, Lee Tressel, coached at Mentor back in the late 50s, and Jim Tressel was actually born in Mentor, Ohio, where I came from. And it's a small world. Goes into the tremendous pressure that's on the coaches today to win and the athletes to perform. A lot of these guys, myself included, when we go to college, we have basically no money. And we generally come from homes that if you don't get a scholarship, you're not going to school. And it's really, the NCAA has these rules and they try and follow them, but it's very difficult. And hopefully, you know, Jim sticking up for his guys, he had to resign. But hopefully down the road, there will be some things developed that will alter the rules that kind of make it more of what's going on in the world today than just these college athletes making these universities and everything lots of money and really not getting too much in return. But my years at UVA were absolutely unbelievable. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. Learned so many things. Because when I got drafted by the Redskins after 4 years, and I did graduate in 4 years, my dad had Tom Falters do a little study for us on the graduation rate and so on in our class. There were 1,333 of us in our freshman class. 728 of us graduated in 4 years. And that's about 54%. And the other 250 graduated in 5 years. Now, some of those guys were, I guess, engineering school and so on, so that would maybe account for that. But we had a total of about 73% that actually graduated from our class, which I think is pretty amazing. We lost about 250 kids along the way. Some people died. We had, how many, you can't answer this, but how many guys do you think in our class of 71 got kicked out because of an honor code? Anybody?
Four.
Eight. Which, that seems like a lot to me. I don't know. But when we were here, the honor code was, wow, that was a wake-up call. I was scared to death, even taking a test to look anywhere but in front of me. And that's why my C's were very well earned. Being here, you know, this is where you grow up. This was the best 4 years of my life. Of course, I got kids; those are great too. But you really mature here, and you learn things that carry you through the rest of your life. And it's an honor for me to be in an institution like University of Virginia that attracts you kind of guys, and really we make a difference in the world. I mean, I'm sitting with some great people. And it's just an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate the information sharing with us. And our last panelist is Dr. Sam Brand. And Sam has, as you'll see, his bio is brief. Okay, his bio is brief and what you have in your hands today. But let me say, his research, his learning, his teaching, his involvement in his specialty urology has been significant to the treatment of prostate cancer throughout the world, not just in America. And he started right here as an undergraduate. And let's welcome Dr. Sam Brand.
Thank you, Mike, and thank all of you all for coming. Before I start, I promised Andy a commercial announcement. Please give to Andy's personal scholarship fund.
Thank you.
Now,
you got to finish too.
Yeah, I'm going to do it at the end too. Also, just in case you didn't catch it earlier. The other thing is that Mike had wanted me to talk about urology, and that's one of these fields that people don't really come up to you in a cocktail party usually talk about. Most of our patients, when they come in, don't want to tell even the nurse what they're there for. So if you want to talk urology and you want to go out in a hall, we can do that. But I don't think many of you will want to talk about your personal problems in front of your classmates. So, but I'm free to answer. That's why there's not much on the thing. When Mike asked me to talk, he said, just sort of reminisce about what's going, what went on while you were here and so on. And I'm thinking about all the things like Mike Murphy's Jaguar, Larry Williams' skiing expertise, Ike and Alice, the SAE house, hiding in the bushes when the state police are coming across the wall, living on the lawn and that sort of stuff. And I could go on for that for probably 3-4 days. And I decided maybe that wouldn't cut through my time. So I wanted to focus just on a couple things. The first is, I grew up over in Stanton. We only had 4 people from our high school come over here, and 2 didn't make it through the first year. So, and the one person besides me that graduated was a couple years behind me graduating. But, you come from a small town, and I actually spent a lot of time here. My grandparents lived over here, so I knew Charlottesville. I originally applied to the Naval Academy. It was turned down because I wore glasses and went early decision here. And then the person who had given me my appointment for the Naval Academy, my member of the house, it was a Yale graduate, came to my high school and said, I graduated from Yale, and Yale has this affirmative action program, and then they don't want just, white Northeastern, private school boys, they want some white Southeastern boys too. and offered me a scholarship to Yale, and I said, are you kidding me? I'm going to the University of Virginia, and it's still, I think, the best decision I ever made. One of the things that, as I was thinking about, what struck me about coming here were the black umbrellas. And for those of you who can remember walking from the dorms to class on a rainy day over the Emmett Street Bridge, there's like a sea of black umbrellas. Everybody had a black umbrella, and everybody had a white raincoat. And it sort of was a metaphor because, we were all the same, but we were all very different. And I think that that's sort of, where we all came from. Last time I was talking to one of our classmates who said that, Larry Williams was the first Protestant white boy he'd ever met, that where he grew up, you were Jewish, or you were Catholic, or you were black. And yet we all, as a group, were bound together. And I think, for the better for all of us. One thing also about the black umbrellas is Dan talked about the honor system. My roommate, Mark Abraham, said that the honor system applied to everything except for the black umbrellas. Because you walk out of class and somebody else's umbrella is hanging where yours used to be. So I did want to talk a little bit about the honor system and just the community of the university. When you first came here and you went through that first week of orientation and you were given the blue sheet, it made a huge impression on you. And like Dan, it made you really focus on being trustworthy, and you trusted everybody at the university. The old thing about you could leave your lecture notes on the steps of Capitol Hall and come back a week later was true. And I will say that the year before we graduated, Rucker McCarty's stereo tape being taken out of his lawn room was not an inside job. Everybody just assumed that that was somebody not from the university, because that's how strong our honor system was. People left their lawn rooms open. And I think that was sort of the beginning of the change. The other thing was the faculty-student relationships, which I thought were spectacular. I mean, we were a fairly small university at the time. We, you know, most of us, you know, knew our faculty personally. Our faculty knew us personally, and I just single out one that many people know, Ken Elzinga, who is you know, came to the university about the same time we did. He was brand new, right out of Michigan State, had a TA named George Hoffer. But Ken was a charismatic, you know, teacher. He was probably responsible for more of us going into economics majors than probably any other individual in, you know, I could ever think of. And he was a role model as a teacher. And as I went through my career as teaching, I always look back at, you know, how Ken taught is a way of you know engaging students. And he's been a friend for a long time. I've actually gone around the country and given several talks on medical economics and used his expertise to help me design the supply and demand curves and all the other things to show how we are where we are based upon Ken's modeling. And the other thing is that at the time we were in the middle of a huge, you know, societal upheaval. I mean, we had things going on, you know, in our world. We, you know, the race relations were changing in the United States, gender relations were changing in the United States, we're in a war, and so on. And yet, during that time, we still had the ability to communicate with faculty. And that was either done through, you know, individuals or through student leaders or through the Friday Club or something, but there were always, there was always that line of communication open, which I think really sort of helped keep things together here at the university. One I'll point out is Lee Middleditch. When Tom Adams and Bill Fryer and I were head of the Cavalier Daily, Lee called us into his office and said, you know, abortions are legal in the state of Virginia, but abortion referral ads are not, and you better cut those ads out. We were getting ads from our national ad agency, so we just cut them out, and that was in October. So in May, several weeks before graduation, I went away with the lacrosse team for a week and came back, and they were trying to find me to arrest me for running abortion ads. And so Fryer, myself, and Adams all got arrested for running abortion ads in the paper. And Irby Cawthon, who was at the time the dean, put up bail by putting his house up for us to get us, to keep us from going to jail. And that's just it's a relationship that you wouldn't find at most universities. One of the things that about people who graduate from university is they tend to have a very strong work ethic and high integrity. We developed a system of core values, and we're pretty much taught to stick to your core. And I think that, again, the honor system is greatly important for that. The other thing is we're taught to think for yourself. And there's some very, you know, interesting people here at the university that did think out of the box. For example, there's a researcher at the University of Virginia Hospital who started looking at Helicobacter as a cause of ulcers. Now, for those of you who don't know much about ulcer disease, there is hundreds of years of papers written about how to operate for ulcers, bleeding ulcers, and all this sort of stuff, and was thought to be because of diet and all this other things. And this guy is on this thing about this Helicobacter. Well, turns out he was right. But I mean, everybody at the time saying this guy's a nutcase. Another member of the faculty at the university, over at the hospital, was looking at viral contamination in hands and actually participated in this research, where they would actually put virus particles in your hand and found that that's how you transmit colds, by shaking hands, not by coughing in somebody's face. And so, you know, but this is thinking out of the box that was sort of unique to this institution. Certainly, as I graduated, we continued to have this community of friends. I remember standing on the steps of the rotunda, and we're talking about what we're doing, and Jim Bradshaw says, "Well, I'm going to go work for this land development place called Sea Island, Hilton Head." And we said, "Where the hell is that?" And, you know. And I didn't see Jim for 20 years until we're sitting in the president's box at a football game, and we struck up the relationship, and it's almost like we never missed a beat. And we've been great friends since. Tom Schillwanker, Bill McElwain, and Wally Andrews, my roommates in medical school. I mean, we, Bill and I went down to Duke together. For those of you who have not been through a surgical residency, it's like an immersion event. For 120 hours a day, you're in the hospital. And 120 hours a week. Seems like a day. Maybe it was. But you tend, in urology, to hang with all urology people, but still, those of us who went to the University of Virginia hung together also. And as I said, it is more of a community. And I think that, you know, then from then I moved on down to Atlanta. I was on the faculty at Emory for 16 years. I was head of the department for 9. You know, Larry Williams and Mark Perung and Roby Robinson were very helpful in helping me set up a research foundation, raise money for a chair. And again, it was part of the university community. And then as things went on, I became chair. I think some of the things that we brought up both by the president of the when she was giving her talk is maturity and leadership. I mean there's a thing about University of Virginia graduates that's different than most schools. I mean, you know, they've come out as leaders, and I was in charge of hiring residents at Emory as part of my job, and I'd have 300, 400 applications for 3 positions, and so I, you know, basically select 50. And gave preference to Emory students because they were our students, but also gave preference to University of Virginia students. And over a period of a couple of years, it taken from my 18 residents, 8 were from the University of Virginia. And my faculty were just sort of giving me, oh yeah, you know, you're biased and stuff. But every year, the resident of the year, you know, because in urology you do 2 years of general surgery, the resident who came from the University of Virginia in my program was usually named the intern of the year in the Department of Surgery. And again, it speaks highly to the work ethic and so on. You know, I think that, you know, that you're taught to stick to your core values, and I think most of us do. It's sometimes very difficult in academic medicine when people are not exactly upfront, you know, to stick to your core values, but, you know, I think that many of us do, and maybe I think that allows us to sleep at night. It may not sometimes be the most prudent way to advance politically. I joined the Medical Alumni Board, I can't remember, 15, 20 years ago, a long time ago, and was on it, seemed like forever. And eventually, you know, wound up being the president of the Alumni Association. And, but for, it was supposed to be a 2-year thing, it ended up being almost a 4-year thing because I was helping as the president-elect, the president at the time. But there was a very dysfunctional relationship between the medical alumni, the medical foundation, and the university, to where the development office and the trust foundation weren't even talking to each other, and it was like going to a meeting of the Palestinians and the Israelis. I mean, as soon as somebody opened their mouth, the other person yelled at them. And this went on and on. But again, you know, to go back to, you know, the way, you know, the university is always run. Bob Sweeney, who was a vice president, you know, and I sat down and we worked out a deal, and it was for the better for the university. And we took some of our younger members of the board, and we were able to negotiate a great deal for both the Medical Alumni Association, who's now in the fold of the development office, and for the university. This is sort of a circle of life. I mean, we all have, we're all alumni, but many of us, you know, bring our kids back, and we certainly brainwash our kids. I had one daughter come here undergraduate, one daughter who decided that when we moved to Richmond, that Dartmouth was a little bit farther away and maybe more discreet. But she turned around and came back here to medical school. And I think, you know, she, even though Dartmouth is a wonderful school and very much like what the university was when we were here, I think she feels very close to the university, as close or closer than she does to Dartmouth. There's a spirit here that in the 6 years I was at Duke, the 16 years I was at Emory, you just didn't see that like you see here. There's a sort of a love of the university, there's a love for the traditions of the university, you develop this moral compass, critical thinking, and so on. And as I said, I think our class was sort of put into the crucible. We with all the societal changes, we were able to forge our close ties. I mean, I come here and talk to many of you all, it's like, you know, I've never missed you. Or maybe, well, that, I mean that in a positive sense. So one time, President Castine came to Atlanta, and Larry was there, and he was sort of talking about the different classes, and he said that, you know, the class of 1970 and 1971 were the two classes that accomplished more than any other class in the entire history of the university. And I think part of it was what we went through, you know, during the time. I think part of it is speaks to the people in the class, and I would think that, you know, that this class is held together. We've had the glue like Mike Moose, and and Tom Falders and Andy and Larry who just kind of hold us together. But I think of the 4 years I spent here, I have more memories, more friends, and have more enduring relationships than I ever, than anything I've ever done. Thank you.
Now, while you're thinking about any comments or questions you want to raise, let me get a little gift here for our panelists. Let me just slip behind you for just a second, and we're going to open this up to questions. And I know in their comments, many of you in this room were mentioned. And so if you have anything to say to them, feel free. And Jim, on behalf of the Alumni Association, we'd like you to have just a little gift of our thanks for being with us, Cindy, also today. And Dan,
thanks,
from the Alumni Association, and Sam.
If you have a corkscrew, we'll share this with everyone.
Well, okay. That's right. And, wow, what marvelous comments today and sharing from beginning where you all grew up and have come then to Charlottesville and beyond. What a great group to share with us today. Now, we have some more comments. We've got some time. We do have to be out of the room around 3 o'clock. And so, you don't have to have a question. You might want to say something that might link up in any way, shape, or form to what our panelists have shared with us today. Their experiences may be similar to yours. And let's just say comments or questions, input of any type. Please, just let me know. Larry, yes.
Well, Mike, I've got to tell the story. Sam knows me, living in Atlanta, but there were a half a dozen of us, Henry Bowden, Robbie Robinson, Ed Mitchell, Everett Dauphmeyer, that were sort of guys that promoted the best kids we could find to attend the university. And Dr. Bob Harbin, who was in our class and actually graduated a year early, because Bob was, he was so anxious to make money, he had to get out of Virginia in a hurry. So Dr. Bob calls me one day, he says, Larry, I've got this guy. He says, you know, he sells me lens implants. And I said, he's got this daughter, and she really wants to go to Virginia. Would you be willing to sponsor? I said, like, I don't know if Madam, I can't do that. So would you make her sign me? This is a very impressive young lady. So I'm thinking, how is this going to ever work? Because if you go through the process when Jack was running the show, you know, well, how long have you known the family? How long have you known the kid? Well, no, I don't know the family. I don't know the kid. I wasn't going to work. So I called Roby up. I said, Roby, I really want you to take 15 minutes to meet with this girl. So he meets with her. And I said, Ed Mitchell, I want you to meet. So I send her around what I'll call the Atlanta guys that were really active in promoting kids. And Roby calls me up. He says, Williams, who is this girl? I said, I don't know. It's Harbin's lens implant supplier. I mean, you know, what's the big deal? And he says, I'm going to tell you, I asked her, why do you want to go to the University of Virginia and not Vanderbilt or not, North Carolina? And she said, well, I've got to go to a place that seems to be so loyal and excited about where they went to college 30 or 40 years ago. I just need to be a part of that experience. So the footnote to the story is Jack was getting a little tired of us being pushing our kids up in Charlottesville a lot. So he calls Roby up and he says, Roby, do you or Williams or Dauphmeyer have any business relationship with her father? No. What, do you have any social relationship with this guy? No. And then, well, why are you so active? So Roby tells Jack Blackburn what she had told him. He says, okay, she's in. So that's my anecdote.
That's great, Larry. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And please, any other comments, questions, just stand up, raise your hand, say anything you want. Anybody at all? Yes.
The only comment I'd make is that, and we all know this, I'm not saying anything, it just seemed like such a tremendous time of transition and change from sport coats and ties. Many people wore suits the first year. By the second year was dying out, by the fourth year with blue jeans and fatigues or t-shirts and shorts. I mean, that was rather dramatic. That was a big change in tradition. Co-education came in. Minority recruitment was very heavy. First year, or fourth year was the first year we had women, but
1970 was the first year there
for
women,
but on the football team, the first time we had scholarships.
Wow, right.
But it really was a time of change, and the whole thing you mentioned, the social and, you know, civil rights and Vietnam War, it really was a time, for me, at least, of turmoil. I mean, I was torn quite a bit by all that was going on.
I'm a very traditional guy. High level of deference and respect and all the things. Yes. But it was a difficult time for me in that way. Yeah. So as much as I love the experience, it threw some curves at me that I wrestled with.
Yes, yeah, I know what you mean. That certainly. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, Harry McGree.
I just wanted to add a short comment on it. I think the 4 years that we were there was probably, I'm not a historian of Virginia history, UVA history, but it may have been the most dynamic 4 years of the history of the university.
Yes, you're right, Harry. Good point. Good point. Yes.
I think part of the uniqueness of the experience of college for me in Virginia, which was shared by everybody, was the honor system. And I think it's endured here in a way that colleges that came late to the idea of an honor system might not have had a chance to put it into practice the way we did through tradition. But also, in these, Sam mentioned that part of the reason that class of 70 and 71 were so successful was that we came from this very difficult period where, as you just mentioned, the college was in transition. So many things changed. But it wasn't so much the change, really, as the way Virginia reacted to it. And I think that the college, unlike a lot of other schools that sort of went over the deep end, we kept our moorings. We stayed. You sense that the student body was largely conservative, but that they didn't want to be kind of left out of the things that were going on at other campuses. And the way Virginia kind of reacted at the time of May Days came down from Edgar Finley Shannon, who sort of steered that very difficult line between being kind of reactionary and being with some of the ideas that the students were bringing forward.
Yes, yes. Good point, good point. And if I may interject also, just for myself, I know during the 4 years we were here, a lot happened musically. As you know, I enjoy music and WVA and all that. I just have a quick question for everyone here. If you would just raise your hand. How many here attended any or all of the Woodstock Festival? Anybody here? Just curious. I'm just to share with you. Look around. No one here went to Woodstock. I did not go. I had to work that summer. I was a mailman in Washington, D.C.
You saw the movie.
See the movie downtown, please. You want to see the movie here, go downtown. But I did not go, you know, and that's one thing I kind of wish. I look back, not that that's any big earth-shattering moment. Yes, sir.
Well, I didn't attend it, but I was the head of the booking of the bands for the University Union in 68, 69, and 70. That was what I did. And I was reading a novel on the end of my period, Point Clear, in August. And someone came out and said, there's a phone call from you. And it was an agent from the William Morris Agency. And he said, I think I've got homecoming set for you, and I know I have Christmas set for you. I'm at this muddy field in North New York State called Woodstock. And he said, I just heard this band called Pacific Gas and Electric, and they're going to change their name to Chicago, and Three Dog Night, and I can get them for $5,000 total for you if you want it. And I said, well, I think I want it, but I've already booked Sly and the Family Stone for homecomings. He said, well, Janis Joplin will come for $5,000 against 70% of the gate for Christmas. And I said, well, we'll book that.
So a great example of some of the organizations we were in did bring us in contact with some great people of our time. Now, in addition to all of the great professors who were here, many who are gone, Dean Woody, Dean Bice, so many. I mean, I could go on. And some are still here. Professor Elzinger, one of my favorites, put us in contact with those here in the university community. But some of our organizations, like Zeb you had there, brought you in contact with people that not everyone had a chance to meet. For those who did not get a copy, I do have, I'm going to leave them here, if you didn't get them when you registered, the big weekend list for our 4 years. This is the big weekend list of everybody who performed, the date they performed, and the cost of the ticket. And if I can share with you here, The Lovin' Spoonful was $3 a person. I'm just picking that one around, on October 28th of 67. And the WUVA alumni group helped me put this together. This was kind of a labor of love. We verified stuff with Cavalier Daily online, and we talked to some folks throughout the class. And then we'll have more copies at the registration table and tonight. If you need more, let me know. But there's a big weekend list. There are a few we don't remember, okay? That's right. If you see a question mark and can help me out, feel free. There are a couple of question marks on the big weekend list. Also, well, no one here went to Woodstock, but if anybody wants the three-day agenda of who played and every song that was played at Woodstock, I've got a few copies here of the Woodstock three-day song list. August 1769 was my 20th birthday, but as I said, that wasn't the reason I couldn't go. I was working at the D.C. Post Office then. But so many great examples. Comments, please. I mean, we're working with Zeb here, and my gosh, that's a hard act to follow, Zeb. But Don Lovett.
Mike, I just have 1.5 comments to make. You know, some of us were indeed engineers, and because of that, some of us, like Howard Wilkinson and myself, got to spend 5 years at this great university. So some of you can eat your hearts out. And we did wear coats and ties for 5 years.
Some of us got to spend 5 years from not being
Yes. That's right, Don. Thank you.
I wore a tie to every class that I attended. Now, my fifth and final year, I didn't attend many classes.
Okay.
Every one I went to, I wore a tie.
Wonderful, Howard. I will share you one experience, and this is, we still have some time, but with WVA, I was also very honored. I was able to interview the entertainers who came to the university from November 67 to November 68. And, you know, and you think back and you look at some things that, well, I could have done better. One, I only took a camera backstage once, and that was only with Martha and the Vandellas. Don't ask me why. But on the good side, I always took 3x5 cards or the concert poster to get their autographs. So all the entertainers you pretty much see from November 67 to November 68, I have the autographs. And they were very gracious people to speak to. And all the greats were here. I was with Louisville 4 years. I only interviewed for 1 year because I really didn't have time to do all the interviews anymore. But I kind of wish I had done them because many of my favorite groups came through here for a second, third, or fourth year. One of those was the Guess Who. Anybody remember the Guess Who concert? I'll share with you a little adventure there. Fred Thompson, right here. Fred, raise your hand. Fred Thompson was class of 72. He was my fourth year roommate. Fred was president of Circle K. Circle K sponsored the Guess Who on October 20th, 1970. They were they were the number one song group in America, basically. American Woman had hit number one in March, and they were riding high on Share the Land, even with the departure of Randy Bachman. And I told Fred, I said, Fred, when you go to pay it, Fred, how much did they cost?
Well, I had an experience similar to that one. When I finished school, I had $5,000 in debt. That was basically what it cost me to go here, all my expenses, all my tuition, so forth. In that period, I wrote a $5,000 check made out to Guess Who.
yes, right. Fred paid the Guess Who the night of the show, and I told him before the concert, I went, they were one of my favorite groups and still are to this day. For a lot of reasons, but I told Fred, I said, Fred, since Circle K, because Fred was president, and WUVA, we're going to have a joint ring party at the house I lived in, which was 415 14th Street. We nicknamed it Wanton Hall for whatever reason. And I said, why don't you invite the Guess Who to the party? He said he would, and we figured we would never see them again, because the show didn't probably end until, what, midnight or so. And these guys were pretty beat. They put on a super show. Burton Cummings was super. We thought we would never see them again. So we all went back to my house at 415 14th Street, and we had mixed the grain, having fun, Circle K, WUVA. Everybody's having a great time with our dates, and there's a knock on the door. And I open the door, and there's Burton Cummings and the Guess Who? And their driver. I don't know who their escort, he was an announcer with a radio station in town here, maybe WELK. I don't recall who the escort or driver was. He brings in Burton Cummings and the Guess Who. and they come in and they have a little few drinks and they party with us. And I give them a little tour of the house. And I'll tell you one thing they got a kick out of. I took them into my kitchen. And at that time, my landlord was undergoing a little renovation for my kitchen. And there was no sink. There was no sink. It was just, you know, the counter and some big openings, no sink. And the guess who just kind of freaked out on that one? You know, where's the sink in this place? I said, well, you know, we're waiting for a new one. We're waiting for a new one. In 2001, Burton Cummings was a guest on a radio talk show in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I happened to be listening to the show that day. And I called in, and I got through. And I told him, we have a lot of fans in North Carolina. And I said, Burton, I said, I don't know if you remember University of Virginia, there was a party. He said, well, you know, went to so many parties, I can't really remember. And it was a big, busy time for all of those musicians. I said, well, my house didn't have a sink. He said, well, I remember something about maybe that one, you know? He said, something about a sink in late 1970. He said, I remember something about it, but I don't remember your party in particular. But he was a very gracious guy to talk to on the radio in about 2001. In fact, they were in New York on 911. They had performed in New York. They're Canadians, of course, but have a lot of love for America. And they had performed in New York, and they were not that far from the Twin Towers. They were a little bit up Manhattan from there when it happened. And they continued their tour wherever they were going. So they're still in the music business now and then.
Right.
Yes. Yes, please.
Some of you may remember the Fifth Dimension concert on the lawn.
Yeah.
And about 10 or 12 years ago, I was at a benefit concert where the Fifth Dimension was singing and was able to talk to them. And I said something about, you know, I heard them back in the dark ages and stuff. They said that was one of the most wonderful concerts they'd ever done. Just, you know, that they just thought the setting was great. It was a wonderful time to be here.
Yes.
What year was that? That was in May of 68, right? Oh, I have one more. I don't mean to belabor it.
Yeah, May of 68. Just get the list. Yeah.
That was one of the ones that I was, it was some other people involved, Tom Cincinnati and some others. We were booking it, but yes. We had a, afterwards, it was right the week after they won all the Emmys, I mean the Grammys, for Up, Up, and Away. It was the very week after, and we had a reception for them in the West Lawn, West Range. It might have been the Edgar Allan Poe room or the Wilson room. The University Union had a reception for them. And talk about autographs.
Yes.
I had a yellow Brooks Brothers shirt that Marilyn McCoo wrote on it. To Zeb, from my heart to your heart, love, Marilyn McCoo.
That is marvelous. Amazing.
The day before my first divorce was found, my wife washed the shirt.
I don't know about that. That's wonderful. That's what did you about him?
This is a piece of information that I picked up at lunch today. I don't know how many people knew a ZBT fraternity brother of mine, Bob Collector. But Bob Collector was a year ahead of us, and he went on to Hollywood. And unbeknownst to me until today, he was a key writer for Animal House. And what I learned is he based it on the ZBT house.
Oh, my.
Oh,
That is great. Well, I tell you, it's 3 o'clock. Obviously, we still have a few minutes if we need them here. I know everyone has a pretty busy agenda. We've had a great time. Again, let's thank our panelists for being here today. Wow. And there is so much still. The afternoon, you've got receptions, your fraternity houses, clubs, everything. And tonight, and yes, if I may just thank you, Andy, for reminding me. If you would just take a moment for your feedback form, if you would, and as you head out the door, we'll give it to our assistant today. And if you should miss her, please put it on the table. We do ask for feedback for the Alumni Association that so generously puts together these type of events. Yes, Michael Wuerl.
Mike, I just want to thank you for the great job that you've done.
Thank you. Come on. Yeah.
All your support and all your understanding.